We are women, we are strong, we are fighting for our rights, side by side with the men who work the nation's mines. United by the struggle, united by the past, and it's here we go, for the women of the working class.
A bit of an earworm there to start series two of Bounty Museum's Natters. That was the Bounty Women Against Pit Closures with the Women of the Working Class, a song written by Mal Finch and then adopted as the anthem of the Women Against Pit Closures campaign during the 1984 miners' strike. The 40th anniversary of the strike will be the theme of this podcast. In the next 12 months, we'll be sharing interviews from ex-miners and also some of the ladies involved in the Women Against Pit Closures movement. If you head to the link that's in the podcast description, you can hear a version of the Women of the Working Class song that was recorded for our Coal Not Dole exhibition back in 2014, when the Experienced Bouncer Youth Panel worked with Pattern Productions and the award-winning animator Dave Bunting. That film in itself went on to win awards across the world. The Experienced Bounty website is also the place to visit to read more about the 12-month programme that we've got lined up, marking the 40th anniversary of the 1984 strike. This will include exhibitions, a feature production, blogs and a chance for you to share your memories, as well as photographs and documents. In future episodes of the podcast, you will hear from ex-miners and their mining memories, but we begin with a member of the Women Against Pit Closures group, Betty Cook. For those who are unfamiliar with the movement, the Women Against Pit Closures were a national movement of women in support of the miners' strike. As part of this, groups of miners' wives with other women sympathetic to their cause met together to plan their response to the crisis which threatened their families and their communities. They also came to act autonomously as women's groups around gendered interests. Later, the Women Against Pit Closures Bouncy Group spawned a movement of local groups campaigning against pit closures across the country. Along with Anne Scargill, Betty Cook was a founding member of the Bouncy Miners Women Action Group. The interview you're about to hear was recorded at Bouncy Library in 2009 as part of the South Yorkshire Women in Industry Lottery Heritage Fund project, and the interview was conducted by Sue Loy.
So moving forward, so this was the situation when the miners' strike started, and this was when you became involved with the, well, it was the Women Against Pit Closures, wasn't it?
The main reason I had, as you know, we had miners' strikes 72, 74, and my ex-husband was a flying picket. So I was going to work at home with the children. We were cold. DSS attacked families and reduced benefits, and so we were fighting for benefits. My ex-husband's benefits were withdrawn, and we, you know, had to go to tribunal and all that messing about. And so 72, 74 tended to be a cold, hungry time, and I would sit and cry. So once 84 came along, I determined this time I'm not going to sit and cry. This time I'm going to do something about it. Particularly in 84, we weren't fighting for improved wages or working conditions. We were fighting for survival. Not only for us, but for our kids and communities. And that's why I determined in 84 I'm not going to sit at home.
So you'd got your whole family was affected.
Yes.
It would make it extremely difficult. But so how did you find you were treated when you started to campaign against the women, against pit closures? You know, how, you know, were you sort of told to get back to the kitchen sink or?
No, well, what I first of all decided, before I was involved in Women Against Pit Closures, we had a small community centre which myself and a friend had fought for to get established. And so approached social services who were responsible for the building and said, we need soup kitchen. And they said, fine. As long as we didn't use it when they used it for their luncheon clubs, that was fine. So a friend and I went round knocking doors to get whatever we could get to provide a meal. Some of the women came on board who said to me, we don't want to go on demonstrations, we don't want to speak at meetings, but we will help in the soup kitchen. And then immediately I got involved with Women Against Pit Closures. They funded us every week. I used to go to the meetings once a week, and they would fund us each week so that we could buy, food for the soup kitchen. Yes, yeah. And that was another battle, because the local NUM opened a soup kitchen at the Corrie, but just for pickets.
Not for the wives and the children?
No, no. And their reply was, there's a soup kitchen in Barnsley at the Civic, but could you afford the bus fares to go to the Civic? So, again, I never approached the National NUM. I should have done. But at that time, you know, time was of the essence, and so I decided that we would work the soup kitchen and it would succeed. And the union, the local union, summoned me to a meeting and said, you can't open a soup kitchen because you haven't got a building. I have. You've no cookery. I have. You've no cookery. I have. They won't let you use the building. They will, you know. And so I said, look, you know, if you're going to feed the women and the children, that's fine. But if you're not, then I've got to look after the community. And so they decided to bring the wives into me. You know, I thought, if you lot can't sort me out, they certainly can't. You know. So the soup kitchen was very successful. And the main argument was, we had a single parent at Wollacori who was a male. And unless he went picketing, couldn't go to their soup kitchen.
Yes.
So, you know, that was one of the main thrusts, that although I determined we to look after the women and children, we'd also to look after this guy who was a single parent, you know, and make sure that they got a meal. So we just sat off with a soup kitchen, and then the men were getting arrested on the picket lines and losing the jobs, and so we decided as women we'd better start picketing. So we got involved in picket lines and the violence and everything, and then we got scabs at Wollacori. So then we decided we would do soup for the pickets in the morning. So sort of, where do we find time to sleep?
Yes.
Because I was working part time as well. So I used to get home about 8:30 on an evening, have something to eat, have a quick hour, and then be away midnight picketing, and come home about 5 and 6, either do the soup for the pickets, or I think the soup kitchen opened either 2 or 3 days a week. It's awful, I can't remember whether it was 2 or 3 days a week in the soup kitchen as well. And again, facing the police in the community, because they came one day and completely blocked Woolly Edge off.
Mm-hmm.
They just stood in rows and blocked Woolly Edge off. And I determined, this is my community, I live here. And my son had this dog, and she was the most stupidest dog you'd ever met. She was absolutely gone. But I said, come on, Sheba, we're going for a walk. So I walked up to the top of the road and approached the police line. And they said to me, where are you going? And I said, I'm taking the dog for a walk up there. No, you're not, get back down there. I said, excuse me, I live here, you know. It's my community, and if I want to take my dog for a walk, I will, which I didn't, but I was going to.
Yes.
You know. So as I made to move to go through them, one of them went to grab me, and the dog grabbed him. And he jumped back and he said, that bloody dog bites. I said, exactly, officer. She's like you, she's trained to do. And they just parted and we just ran through.
You.
You know, and then one day they came to the top of this estate with the riot shields, kids going out to school, and the sun shining on the riot shields, and the children in the community always call me cooking, you know. And what's that up there cooking? And I said, they're the policemen. They're not policemen. You know, and the children couldn't even visualise that these were policemen, with one little boy whose daddy had died very suddenly. And summertime, they wiped them, so, you know, they used to wipe them and very proud. And kids were going to school, and one of the police was scuffing his plimsoll. And said to him about your dad's a striking miner. You know, just one tear.
Yes, yes.
He said,
yeah.
My dad is dead. You know, and I thought,
yes.
Yes. You know, who do they think they are?
And so, how did they, I mean, you were out picketing as well as the soup kitchen.
Yeah.
How did the miners react to you being on the picket lines as well? I mean, did they want you to be there? Did they accept you being there? Or did they still think...
No, it was amazing. The guys were absolutely amazing. They appreciated what we were doing. And, you know, the social... social time during the coal mining communities tended to centre in a working men's club, and if I went in there with my ex prior to the strike, it would be, you'd be sat there dumb, you know, what do you want to drink sort of thing, and that would be it. But during the strike, it's, where have you been this morning, cookie, what's been happening, what have you been doing?
So they accepted you.
So
doing
they things. Accepted that role. Some of the women didn't.
Yes.
You know, I'd no right being on a picket line, but it had to be done. It was something,
yes,
that it was a need, and we had to meet it as women. We had to meet it, choose what.
So how, I mean, after, at the end of the strike, what happened then? How did you, I mean, it must have been difficult from having been doing the soup kitchen, going on picketing and so on. And suddenly, you didn't need to pick it, you didn't need... Well, I,
well that's
so
what...
Did you carry on with the soup
that's
kitchen?
That's what we thought, you know. Mum used to come and help with the housework, because obviously I didn't have much time for that. And we used to say, when this strike's over, we're going to do A, B, C, D, E. But the strike finished, and yeah, the soup kitchen's closed. But then all of a sudden, we were involved in other campaigns. We called ourselves the Rent-A-Mob, Rent-A-Gob, Rent-A-Picket Squad, you know, wherever workers were in struggle, and internationally as well, we were still going abroad supporting other workers in struggle. And we went to the States, to the Hormel Meat Strikers picket lines and their strike centre, and I've still got the T-shirt that says Cram Your Spam. And my son's partner loves spam, and I say, no spam in this house.
Yes.
You know, and please don't use spam when I come there. But because they were meat packers, they also were little ranchers and had little areas of land, and most of them had at least one horse. And so when the National Guard appeared on their mounted horses, the ranchers decided they'd approach the picket line on their horses.
Right.
And their horses were ruled unroadworthy. So, and just moving up to last week, the events of last week with the demonstrations in London and the policeman that attacked the woman,
mm-hmm,
who wasn't wearing a number.
Yes.
How many times did we tell people during the strike this was happening? The police were wearing numbers, you couldn't identify them, whatever you did, you couldn't identify them, and I don't think people believed it.
Yes.
But, you know, thank goodness for that cameraman last week.
Yes.
That,
yes,
picked that up. And thank goodness that it got through in the correct concept, because,
yes,
you know, people have admitted since that, yeah, we did film newsreels, and we did turn it round to make it appear that it was the pickets that were creating violence.
Yes.
Silence on both sides. But if you're being attacked, you
yes,
attack back.
Yes, you do.
And one morning on Woolley Edge, the police were going berserk, and they were also, you know, when they link up.
Yes.
And they've all got to link to hold the line. And the inspector was screaming at them, hold the line. And I turned around and they'd got my son, and thought, they're not having it,
yes,
he's mine. And so because, you know, they were quite a bit bigger than me, I had to go back and run and jump. And I was literally going down the line like that,
yes,
in the faces, you know, it's mine, you're not having him. That,
yes,
was how I was about protecting the community.
Yes.
And in the end, the inspector just screamed, let him go, for goodness sake, let,
yes,
him go.
Because it was reaction, immediate reaction,
yes,
because it's your son.
And does a mother hen protect her chicks? She does indeed. But if you'd have told me before the strike, you know, in another year, 2 years' time, you will be doing this. I'd have said, not me. Oh, no, not me. I wouldn't have done that.
You say during the strike you were still working part-time. Were you nursing part-time?
No, I was a mail order in a call centre. Because when I wanted to go back to work with nursing, you know, obviously then it was shifts. You couldn't choose, you know, part-time or whatever. And so my ex-husband, well, originally he wouldn't let me work. You know, it was against women working. Although he wouldn't provide financially for us, we were struggling. He still wouldn't let me work. And the first reason was I couldn't work shifts. But then eventually I managed to get a job in a mail order company and said to him, if you let me go out to work, I'll pay the rent, which meant was releasing more money in his pocket for behind the pub bar. So, I agreed that I could go to work.
So the fact that you were actually working part-time, did it mean that you sometimes were able to go out on your own without your husband, or was that not, you know, socially, I mean? Was that, you know,
If I had time.
Yes, well, I was going to say, it doesn't sound as if you had much time. I was just thinking, because you said that you went, you know, you went, sort of went to the club with your husband and you'd be sitting there. I mean, did you not go out on your own otherwise before you were working part-time?
Yes. If the girls were going out, yes, I would. He didn't agree with it, and the joke was amongst the girls that I had to be in bed before 11 o'clock with my nightie on, but yes, I would go out without him, yes, yeah.
So it sort of broadened your outlook a little bit, or helped broaden your outlook, the fact that you were working part-time.
Yeah.
No, that's not quite the right term, actually, because you've got to broaden the fact that you were able, gave you a bit more freedom.
Mixing with other people, and again, when I first went to work in the mail order company, it was non-union. And so if the manager took a dislike to you, you know, you'd a heck of a lie. And then when the legislation came in that we could have a trade union, I immediately joined the union and became a shop steward, mainly to make sure that they didn't treat people how they treated myself. It was like I became a school governor, and the first meeting that I went to, I was voted on as chairman of governors, and I had no idea. I didn't even know what a school governor did, let alone a chairman.
So you mentioned that, so after the strike was over, you went and were joining, you know, campaigning against other causes and so on.
Yeah.
So what, did you carry on part-time working?
I carried on part-time working, and during the strike I was introduced to Bob Fryer, who was the principal at Northern College at that time. And we'd obviously been speaking in universities and colleges. And the first time I was asked to speak at a university, I thought, do I do three Hail Marys before I go through the door, you know? Because it had always been my parents' ambitions. They never said to get a degree, it was to get your cap and gown. That was their main ambition for me, but of course it hadn't happened. And sort of going into universities and colleges, and I thought, you know, I'm not as stupid and thick as people keep telling me. And I do know things, and I can speak to these people, and I know some things that they don't know. So when I was introduced to Bob Fryer, I said to Bob, when this strike's over, I'm coming to your college. Not, I'm going to apply for your college, I'm coming. So in 87, I went to Northern College, and suddenly realised that I don't have to be somebody's mother or somebody's wife, that I could be me. And I didn't have to put up with being kept short of money and being controlled. And eventually, I'd got the support, of a network of support, that I was finally brave enough to leave home.
Yeah.
I'd always determined that once I lost my mum, that's what I was going to do, but I wouldn't do it until I lost my mum, because she was old-fashioned, it would have absolutely broken her heart. But you know, my outlook had been so broadened, and I decided this is it. Mm-hmm. And she was horrified, and said, what about your marriage vows? And I said, what about his marriage vows to me?
Yes.
Yeah, so...
So did you go to college before your mum died?
Did she know you went to... Mum was still alive when I graduated.
Brilliant.
And the expression on her face, it was absolutely wonderful. She was so proud and so happy. And that sat near the front so that she could see everything. And I came... And the thing that, the guy... presented me with my degree and kept me talking for about 10 minutes up there on the stage, everybody waiting, you know. And the chair of sociology department was so pleased that, you know, Fred had deigned to speak to me for 10 minutes. And as I came down, I'm saying, Mum, that's for you. And we're both crying. And she said, no, it's yours. You know? And this bit of paper that wasn't anything, just going back and forwards between us. Yeah.
So what happened then? You say you left your husband. And did you get a job using your degree? Or
I still worked part-time while I was at college and while I was at uni. And... just at the end of 1999, they started asking for voluntary redundancies at work. And by this time, I was 61. And I'd also previously applied for voluntary redundancy, and they wouldn't give it me. And I said to this time, if you don't give it me, I'm going to be very, very upset. And so they gave me my voluntary redundancy.
And this was from the same mail order firm that you'd been working?
Yes, I've been 30 odd years with them.
Gracious me.
Yeah.
Well, that was a long time.
And then we had a shared house as students. We had a shared house. One was a fellow student, one was a tutor at Northern College, and she decided she was going to move back to London and teach in London. And so because the other one was a guy, we sat, all three of us sat and discussed it, and she said, do you want me to get another student to share? And the students and students aren't there, and so we talked it over, and we said, no, we will stay as we are, And then Bill became very, very ill, so I was thrown into the role of an unpaid carer, and I hated it.
Yeah.
I did it because there was nobody else to do it, and he would have had to go into care. And although he needed 24-hour care, his brain was still active. And so I was sort of pushed into that role as an unpaid carer. But then Bill died, and I had a few months at home, and then I decided I'm bored with this lot. Did voluntary work for the Salvation Army, but that still wasn't enough. So I went back to work again, and I'm still working now, part-time. Keeps me out of mystery.
But you still get involved with causes at various times, you were saying?
Yeah, we've got very close links with the NUM still, and they invite Anne and myself to the weekend schools. We go to their weekend schools, and they invite us to their functions, and that's really good that we've still got this link. And now the Yorkshire NUM in particular are doing education within the community. So only this week I took the guy who was responsible for the education within the community to the Salvation Army. We invited him to lunch at the Luncheon Club for the Elderly. But I got a phone call to say, we use the people that are doing the community hours to help us. And I got a phone call to say, nobody's turned up. There's only Alan in the kitchen. So I said, okay, we'll come now. So this poor guy that was invited for lunch was given an apron and said, you can help serve, you know, we need you to serve. But it's forging links because... the envoy that's at the Salvation Army at the moment is moving into Maltby, where there's practically nothing in that area. It's a very run-down area.
Yes,
so hopefully we're going to be able to two-prong it with the Salvation Army and further education as well.
Yes,
And build our education courses between the NUM and the Salvation Army, which, you know, can only be positive.
Can only be so.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's fine. I think it might be. That's great. Thank you very much for your... It's been very interesting talking to you. Thank you very much.
I don't know.
You can hear even more from Betty on the Experience Bowser website in a video filmed for the Cole Not Dole exhibition back in 2014. We'll have more interviews from the Women Against Pit Closures group in future episodes. Our next episode will focus on oral history recordings from local historian Brian Elliott, who has interviewed countless of miners over the years. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to share your mining memories on the Barnsley Museum socials, or you can email experiencebarnsley@barnsley.gov.uk.
We are women.